History Surrounding the Move from Agrarian to Industrial Capitalistic Society was presented by David Crabtree on August 10, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of the teaching.
And the reading divides into three sections. The first section talks about the pin factory. Second section talks about raising tariffs on imported goods. And the third section talks about education, in particular public-funded education. And I'm going to talk about each of those and give my little synopsis of each section, and then I'm going to make some general comments. And if there's time afterwards, we can do some questions and answers. In the first section, the question that he's trying to answer is, what is the wealth of a nation really? And that's when he gets into this discussion of the production of these pins and how that works in an industrialized economy as opposed to the less developed economy. What he's doing is he's acknowledging that Europe has moved into a new era. It is now in a situation where the markets that Europe has available to it are much larger than they have ever been before. And that is because you can ship things, you can transport things by sticking them on a boat, and with relatively little labor, and that's your main cost, those could be taken halfway across the world and sold someplace else. So transportation costs are relatively small. That's very significant. That's a very big change from what Europe has experienced up to now. Most of the transportation of goods that occurred in Europe prior to the early industrialization was by land. And agricultural goods in particular, I remember reading, if they had to be transported more than 10 miles by wagon, it wasn't worth the effort. You couldn't recoup those costs because overland transportation was so expensive. So transportation costs are a major factor. But if you can put those goods on a ship and those ships can take it someplace else, your transportation costs are relatively insignificant. And in the 16 and 1700s, we have a situation that has developed in which sea transportation has become very easy, safe, relatively safe, and cheap. So now we've got huge markets available to every producer. Before, if you had a little factory and you wanted to quadruple production, there's nothing you could do with the excess goods that you produced. There was no market for it, because your market was just a local market. But now we've got a situation in which, for all intents and purposes, the market is infinite. So if you can increase production, you can find people to buy those goods. That's new. That's part of what Adam Smith is taking into account. So now this possibility of mass production becomes important, and people give thought to how that can happen. And in mass production, the cost per item go way down. And so now we can sell those goods thousands of miles away to a place where they even produce that same good. But because I have used mass production methods, I can sell it cheaper than people can buy it from the domestic producer. That's huge. And the key to this mass production is localization. You want to reduce every task to a simple task that could be done by anybody. All you need is just generic human labor. No training, or as little training as possible. You just plug someone into a slot and they do their task. If everybody does that, out the other end, we have lots and lots of pins being churned out. And if we can do that, we drive the costs way down and everyone benefits from those lower costs. Let me read a couple of paragraphs. It's from the reading that you read, but I just want to underscore these. He says in section 1.1.10, he says, it is the great multiplications of the productions of all the different arts in consequence of the division of labor which occasions, in a well-governed society, that universal opulence which extends itself to the lowest ranks of the people. Every workman has a great quantity of his own work to dispose of beyond what he himself has occasion for. And every other workman, being exactly in the same situation, he is enabled to exchange a great quantity of his own goods for a great quantity, or what comes to the same thing, for the price of a great quantity of theirs. He supplies them abundantly with what they have occasion for, and they accommodate him as amply with what he has occasion for, and a general plenty diffuses itself through all the different ranks of the society. So this is, you've heard the term trickle down. Well, this is that concept, trickle down, that everyone, even the most lowly worker, benefits from this increase in productivity and the lower prices. Another section, this is 1.1.11. He says, if we examine, I say, all these things, and consider what a variety of labor is employed about each of them, we shall be sensible that without the assistance and cooperation of many thousands, the very meanest person in a civilized country could not be provided, even according to what we very falsely imagine, the easy and simple manner in which he is commonly accommodated. Compared, indeed, with the more extravagant luxury of the great, his accommodation must no doubt appear extremely simple and easy. And yet it may be true, perhaps, that the accommodation of an European prince does not always so much exceed that of an industrious and frugal peasant as the accommodation of the latter exceeds that of many an African king, the absolute master of the lives and liberties of 10,000 naked savages. So he's comparing the benefits that have accrued to your common worker in Europe being of such a magnitude that he enjoys comforts that a king in Africa that is undeveloped could only dream of. So Adam Smith is answering the question, what is wealth, by saying, it's not gold. It's not what the mercantilists are telling us. It's not gold and silver. Wealth is productivity. If you can produce a lot, you're wealthy. And that has huge implications. We'll talk about, I'm sure this will come up throughout the week, but one of those is, therefore, the amount of wealth in the world is not fixed. The mercantilists would say it's fixed. It is equal to the amount of gold and silver in the world, and no more. And the only way you can expand that is dig more. But Adam Smith would say, no, as long as you can keep becoming more productive, you're becoming wealthier. It's not fixed. It's only as fixed as our creativity is fixed. The second question that he's answering, and this is in the second section, and this is, again, coming back to a mercantilist assumption that you need to do everything you can to stimulate domestic production, and you want to export more than you import. And that would suggest then that tariffs on imported goods would be a good thing. So that was the argument that mercantilists would make. And Adam Smith is saying, it's not clear that that's the case. It's not clear that that actually benefits a nation more than not having tariffs. So here's what his logic is. Wealth, from his perspective, is domestic productivity. That's what I just mentioned. Tariffs could make sense, just given that, but he goes on. Cheaper goods from abroad are to be seen as an opportunity. That if somebody in another country can make widgets cheaper than we can, we should see that not as a threat to our widget-making capacity, but we should see that as an opportunity to take advantage of cheap widgets. And the way we need to see that is our domestic widget makers need to either get a lot more efficient so they can beat the prices of the foreign widget makers, or they need to redirect their energies to making something other than widgets. That will be a better use of our resources. That will be more efficient. He goes on to argue, don't worry about domestic production, because people in our country will naturally tend to be more interested in being engaged and helping the domestic economy. Why is that? First of all, because they know the market better. They don't know the market 1,000 miles away, but they know intimately the market here in the community in which they live. Cheaper transportation, even by ship, it costs something, and it's going to cost more than it does to transport it across town. So you combine those two things. He's saying, don't worry about domestic production. People will prefer to be involved in the local economy. So we don't need, and tariffs would only be to our disadvantage because they would encourage inefficiencies. So don't try to use tariffs to encourage domestic production. In the course of making this argument, he refers to the invisible hand. This is the only reference to the invisible hand that occurs in The Wealth of Nations. But I would argue the concept of the invisible hand permeates the whole book. And his concept of the invisible hand is that if individuals will each pursue their enlightened, that is, their informed and knowledgeable, long-term self-interests, that will be to the benefit of the whole, of society as a whole. And behind this is this assumption that the economy is a complex thing, and that there is no one who knows all of the details in an economy well enough to be able to manage that from a central location. There just is no one that has that kind of knowledge. And we see in practice, from experience, that a decentralized decision-making system in economics works better. That is, each individual knows their own conditions better than anybody else could. And if they are smart in the way they think about that stuff, and if they're thinking about their long-term interests, and that's important, their long-term interests, not their short-term interests, then the cumulative impact of everybody making their own decisions will be the most beneficial to society as a whole. And Adam Smith is just stepping back and saying, isn't that incredible? That you turn people loose to do what they're inclined to do anyway, and that will work out better than having someone who centrally plans and orchestrates that. A couple of quotes from section 4, 2, and it's 9 through 11. Smith says, but the annual revenue of every society is always precisely equal to the exchangeable value of the whole annual produce of its industry, or rather is precisely the same thing with that exchangeable value. As every individual, therefore, endeavors as much as he can both to employ his capital in the support of domestic industry, or so to direct that industry that its produce may be of the greatest value, every individual necessarily labors to render the annual revenue of the society as great as he can. He generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it. By preferring the support of domestic to that of foreign industry, he intends only his own security, and by directing that industry in such a manner as its produce may be of the greatest value, he intends only his own gain. And he is, in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always the worse for the society that was no part of it. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. Next section, what is the species of domestic industry which his capital can employ and of which the produce is likely to be of the greatest value? Every individual, it is evident, can, in his local situation, judge much better than any statesman or lawgiver can do for him. And then the last section I'm going to read. To give the monopoly of the home market to the produce of domestic industry in any particular art or manufacture is in some measure to direct private people in what manner they ought to employ their capitals, and must, in almost all cases, be either a useless or a hurtful regulation. That's one of the concepts that Adam Smith is best known for, is the invisible hand, and this is the clearest explanation of that concept that he gives. But as I said, it permeates the book as a whole. So Smith's answer to the question, should there be tariffs, is no, there ought be no tariffs. We need to expose our domestic industry to the competitive environment, which will force it to be more efficient and more productive. And this is what is of benefit to the domestic economy. And it works better to allow individuals to make decisions on the basis of their knowledge of their own situation. This works out better than orchestration from above. The third section deals with education. And the question that he's addressing there is, have those public endowments contributed to, in general, to promote the end of their institution? What he's looking at is a situation in which most of education is publicly funded, either by the government or large endowments from individuals. The teachers teaching in those institutions, therefore, are either paid government employees or they have a guaranteed salary from an endowment fund that is provided for that purpose. So he's looking at the situation in which we have an institution, education, that has been sheltered from the competitive environment. It's not really a part of the market environment. And what is the impact of that? What's the significance of that? What he suggests is that there are several problems with publicly funded education. One is it's less necessary for the teachers to do their job well. They are less motivated to do so because their salaries are guaranteed, whether they do a good job or not. And he points out, when students must go to a certain school to get credentials, that school has a monopoly and is not compelled to do its job well. So the institution as a whole, if it provides a degree that only it can give or only a few like it, it has a monopoly on that kind of degree of any sort, then it is less motivated to do its job well. He points out in the course of that discussion that where teachers are diligent, students are diligent. And his assumption is that if we can motivate teachers to be diligent at their jobs, that students will follow suit and do better. So there are problems with these educational institutions that have guaranteed funding and are sheltered from the market environment. And he points out that privately funded educational institutions generally do better. He points out that those disciplines that are only taught privately are better taught. And I think the examples he gives are, was it dancing and fencing or something? I can't remember the examples, but something like that. The second evidence that he marshals to his aid is that Greece and Rome had private education and people there were well taught. And his third piece of evidence is that women, who generally speaking are not educated in publicly funded institutions, but funded on the basis of paying for their own education, he says that they are particularly well taught because of that. So his conclusion is public education doesn't work very well. Publicly funded education doesn't work very well. That it is better for the schools to be exposed to competitive forces and have to deal with that. However, if that were the case, if education were just on a market basis, then a lot of people wouldn't get educated. And he points out that in this society that's coming into being, this more industrialized society, that society is particularly in need of education. Because this specialization that he had talked about in the first section encourages a kind of intellectual lethargy. That because people are doing the same repetitive job day after day after day, and I will point out that's new, because in an agricultural society, your tasks were extremely varied over the course of a day. You had to know a lot and a wide variety of things. You had to be a good problem solver. And your occupation forced you to be that. But now in an industrialized society, that's no longer the case. You're just kind of a robot, a human robot doing your thing. And that encourages an intellectual lethargy. So education becomes even more important, and especially in an environment where it is not only industrialized, but it is democratic, where political power is diffused throughout the populace. So now everybody out there is making decisions with respect to complicated issues. It would be disastrous for us to have a society where people are brain dead. So education is particularly important in this new environment. So his way out of that dilemma is that there must be education, especially for the common people, and that in order to make that affordable, it's going to have to be partly government funded. It's the only way he sees out of that. It will be elementary education, and it will be very practical in its nature, but it's important that everyone get that basic education. And for those who have greater means, they can go to the universities and and get more extensive education. Okay, so those are the three parts that of the reading that you were assigned. Generally speaking, it seems to me that what Adam Smith is doing is he's reflecting on the changes that he has seen happening in his lifetime. He reads back in history about the medieval period, and he's looking at the economy there and how much different that was than the economy in which he is living. And he just kind of throws up his arms in amazement and says, this is incredible. What is happening is absolutely astounding. And it is not what people would have predicted. There are some elements to it that are what I would say counterintuitive. That an economy that is not organized would be better than an organized economy is one of those counterintuitive notions. You would think, anybody would think, if I were to ask you the question, is an event, is an activity better when it's organized or when it's not organized? You're all going to say it's better when it's organized. So why wouldn't an economy be the same way? And yet the experience of Adam Smith is it's better when it is, I won't call it disorganized, but when it is decentralized, when there isn't centralized organization of that. And there will be other economists who will go on to talk about that, and Hayek will be talking about that in particular. He'll argue it's not disorganized, it's just decentralized decision-making. And the other thing that Adam Smith is pointing out that is counterintuitive is that if people do what is in their own best interests, without even intending it, will do what is better for the economy as a whole. That notion of the invisible hand and everyone pursuing their own enlightened, long-term best interests, that seems counterintuitive. And yet Adam Smith is looking at things, he says, it may seem counterintuitive, but as we look at our experience, that's what works best. That works far better than trying to control it from above. Since then, since Adam Smith, the economy has become far more complex. It's probably become more complex than he could ever have dreamed in his wildest nightmares. But many of the principles that he identified are still acknowledged to be valid and true. That Adam Smith, in the realm of economics, Adam Smith is still a force to be reckoned with. That the ideas that he presented are still significant. And in our time, there are various terms that are used to refer to his perspective. Some people call it free market economics. Other people will call it laissez-faire economics. Others will call it classical liberalism. But there are many people that are still very firm advocates of Adam Smith's perspective. And he established the foundation for any discussion about economics. All of the authors that we are reading this week would be very familiar with Adam Smith's perspectives, and to one degree or another, as they talk, they have his thoughts in the back of their minds. They're interacting with him to one degree or another. Okay, there is time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to interact with that. Questions or comments? I like easy ones.
What do you have in mind when you were stressing the long-term self-interest?
Well, I worked to a medium security institution for juvenile delinquents, and as a counselor for 1 year. And one of the counselors that was training me said that the common thread in all of the inmates is they have a very difficult time thinking in the long term. If they go into a store and they see something that they like, their mind says, take it, walk out of the store with it. They can't think in terms of, but what will that lead to? And what will that lead to? And what will that lead to? So from Adam's perspective, the fact that it's long-term is critical, because otherwise it turns everybody into opportunists looking for their own personal gain on the short run. It may be devastating to themselves and the economy in the long run, but they don't care about that. Let me give you an example. Another example. I went to Russia right after the fall of the Soviet Union, and I was thinking, I had been there when it was the Soviet Union, and I was thinking, and I really liked it. I enjoyed the people, I enjoyed the culture, and I remember thinking when I was there, this would be a great place if it weren't for the Soviet tyranny that exists in this culture. So I was thinking, once that fell, Russia would be a great place. Well, I went afterwards, and was shocked and disappointed. I was there about a year after, maybe 2 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. And there were people acting as little capitalists all over Russia, and it was really ugly. One example, I went to a stand where they were selling apples. A farmer was selling apples off his little plot of land, and they were prepackaged in these brown paper bags. I bought a bag of apples, and I took it home, and the bottom half of the bag was full of rocks. In the long term, that won't work. I'm not going back. On the short term, that worked. He got a sale. What became clear to me is, as they were trying to implement capitalism in Russia, it was opportunism rather than what I think of when I think of an exchange on the market. I think of an exchange in the market as being a win-win situation. I've got more than I need of this, and they've got more money than they need, so we're going to make a trade here. And both come out winning. In Russia, they didn't have that concept going into it. So for them, capitalism was just opportunism. And it's that long-range perspective that was missing, and some other things, but that's a lot of it. So that's why. Yes?
Perhaps you'd want to make a comment then on that topic. If long-term self-interest is a prerequisite for the success of a decentralized establishment, and long-term self-interest is not a given, in other words, it's not natural that, it's not given that people will decide in the long-term self-interest, does that sabotage
the system?
Smith's premise that this system can work? Maybe you want to just comment.
But his system is predicated on people pursuing their enlightened long-term self-interest. So I would say that stands. But if you take the long-term out of it, absolutely, the whole thing crumbles. I think that's absolutely true. There are lots of things that we could talk about here, but this is something that Charlie has mentioned in the past, and the more I think about it, the more confident I am that he's right. Modern-day corporations, stock-owned corporations, are problematic because there is, if we think to a family-owned business, as I am running that business, part of what I'm thinking is, when I die, whatever is left of this thing will be passed on to my heirs. And so I want to leave this in the best condition that I possibly can. So I am going to be thinking, there will be a natural tendency for me to operate this on the long-term best interests. In a corporation that's owned by stockholders, stock owners, generally speaking, they go to where the dividends, the returns, are the greatest. And they aren't thinking long term. They aren't talking hundreds of years. They're talking relatively short term gains. If a company is not providing good dividends or returns, they'll sell their stock in that company and they'll go to one that provides a better return. The more people do that, the more the management of that organization is encouraged to look at just the short run. I am aware of a situation where this was a few years gets to be longer and longer as I get older. But it was in a period of time when I was buying a lot of woodworking tools. And there is a company that had developed a reputation for making good tools that would work. It would stay in good condition for a long time. So you were making an investment when you bought the tools. That company was bought out, had new management, and they decided to replace the metal parts with plastic parts because people would buy that brand because of its reputation. They could keep their dividends real high on the short run, and then the CEO, he's gone and the stockholders are gone. They don't care in the long run how good those tools are, whether they last 3 years or whether they last 20 years, it doesn't matter to them. So if we make that shift to the short term, and I think there are several structures in place that are in our society that are encouraging the short term rather than the long term perspective, that undermines the whole thing. Absolutely.
Seems like another factor that is maybe touched on by Adam Smith, but is really a huge factor now that we brought up in our group was debt. as a productive force, because nations and corporations and individuals are taking on such a high amount of debt that money is a usable force in the economy that wasn't necessarily available before.
Yes.
Do you see that affecting Adam Smith's system one way or the other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, I think Adam Smith would look at that situation and say, how can that happen? Because that's not in their long-term best interest to be that deeply in the debt. But we have done it by kind of like this plank that's out over this cliff. We keep inching a little bit further and go, it's still here. It's still here. We keep going and we get way out there where it's really spongy. And that's how that has come to be. We have so much faith in that plank. But at some point, that plank won't hold us up. I think Adam Smith would look at our situation and say, I said their enlightened long-term self-interest, much like Greenspan in this last economic downturn, said, well, I thought people would act on their own best interests. And they didn't. And he was expressing incredulity at that. And his decisions were predicated on people doing that. And part of that is we need to be enlightened. That education really is important in this. In order to make intelligent economic decisions, we have to know a lot. We have to know how credit works. We have to know how money works. We have to be really cognizant of the fact that that dollar, that piece of paper, can be worthless tomorrow if people's faith in it goes away. It's not inherently worth a dollar. It's only worth a dollar if people have trust in it. We have to understand things like that. Otherwise, we're really vulnerable. And I think, as a culture, we don't understand those things. People don't talk about those things.
Are you ready to call the invisible hand God by his gifting and purposes? Or do you think that God working with his people is could call for more sacrifice or more complications than doing yourself in long term?
Well, there's a sense in which I would not be reluctant to call it God, in the same way that I would call gravity God working. But I think it's just a force at work, an economic force at work in society that kind of does its thing. There's a kind of regularity there. And yeah, that's the way God has set things up. But the invisible hand, from my perspective, there are things that we ought not trust to the invisible hand. I don't think the invisible hand always works the way that Adam Smith is laying it out, that things are much more complicated, that there is an understanding of what it means to be enlightened and what the long-term best interest really is, that he is assuming, that he's absorbed from his culture, that has to be there for this to work well. And without that, the invisible hand is not exactly our friend, I would say. But it is an incredible thing that he has recognized. And I mean, I look at it and I think my response is the same as his. My goodness, that's amazing.
It seems to me as though there's a chance, though, using the two examples you gave, that the invisible hand over time, I have more faith in it than you're suggesting, that the Apple seller, over time, he's going to either go out of business or he's going to figure out that you can't keep putting rocks in the bottom of your bag and selling apples, and he will become more enlightened and change his behavior, or the tool maker, that particular company might indeed have trouble, but you know that they will be a cautionary tale for other tool makers as well as a host of other companies who will say, aha, that's what happens when you cheapen your product. So.
Right.
It seems to me as though enlightenment can come to some degree over time. It might be a different individual, a different company, but it works its way through the market.
Right. I think that's true. But it can be a long time coming. As Cain said, in the long run, we're all dead. It can be a really long time coming. Let's mind experiment. Let's take the farmer in Russia that's selling bags of apples. It could be what he'll choose to do is not put apples in place of rocks in his bag, but he'll decide, I know what that means. I got to keep moving. That's the lesson that I learned. I mean, people are very ingenious.
Yeah, but he won't have the means to move. If he can't sell his apples, he's not going to have the means to move to try to sell the apples somewhere else and get his apples. I mean, there are limitations to that.
Ultimately, there are limitations, but people are very creative. You can have a bad economic system stay bad for a very long time.
But people are also very creative in seeing, aha, he did that. If I want to benefit, I do something quite different, and it actually results in some improvement in the market.
It can happen, right? That can happen. Let me give you another example. My wife decided to raise flowers and put them into bouquets and sell them at a stand, and she bought a book that talked about how to set up that kind of business and stuff, and she was reading in that. And there were these, it was a couple in Texas that decided to have a flower stand. They raised their own flowers, sold their bouquets at this flower stand, and other people wanted to come and sell their flowers at the same location. And their first thought was, no, that would be bad because it would be competition for us. But they decided to take a risk. They decided, no, maybe it would be better if we open it up and let other people come. So that's what they ended up doing. And the end result was that several different flower growers came and located in the same plot of ground. They all sold flowers there. And what happened is it raised the interest throughout the community in buying flowers, and everyone benefited. That is a discovery that it could have been a very long time coming, because it's counterintuitive. Eventually it might, and other people will see that example and think, oh, maybe that'll work here. But there's much about economics and even the long-term best interest that's counterintuitive, and it could be a long time getting over some of those obstacles.
Yeah, and I agree that to some degree that's where ingenuity, creativity. I was wondering, as you're telling your story about going back to Russia, wondering to what degree after communist, and after things changed, to what degree you ran into people who couldn't think for themselves, couldn't exercise that sort of creativity and ingenuity, because that has to be fostered also.
They were pretty creative and ingenious under the Soviet system. There was a whole market, there was a whole economy that existed outside of the official economy. But there are some habits, you're right, there are some habits that were inculcated by the Soviet system that had to be broken down. That's absolutely true. Especially risk-taking. The concept of risk-taking was a huge one, right? That's a whole ethos where risk-taking is seen to be a thing worth doing. You have to develop that. That's not intuitive either. Okay, I'll take one more. One more.
I think with relation to, you were saying you have more faith in the invisible hand concept, that eventually mistakes of others will help correct the behavior of economy and society as a whole. I think it relates very much to what you said about tariffs and about how, I wrote it down, said the idea that tariffs are ultimately harmful, that we need to allow our industries to be exposed to the competitive market, so that they either become more efficient and increase production, or they redirect their energies. It would seem to parallel the example of the government bailouts, mm-hmm. and how we bail out failing businesses, banks, insurers, automakers. Mm-hmm. We should allow our failing businesses to fail, not prop them up artificially, because they need to be an example for this to work. They have to be an example to other businesses of how to fail. That's my thought. I think that's how ultimately it'll work, the invisible hand. Is if we allow failing businesses to fail.
That's the kind of thing, that's a theme we'll be talking about all week long, I think. Okay, thanks.